Welcome to the Straight Talk Physio Podcast with your hosts, Dr. Andrew Junak and Dr. Craig Giambattista. On today's episode, we're going to talk about five of the top 15 healthcare myths and lies that are told to patients every day. We're going to break down each of these myths and give you a better understanding of why you shouldn't let these commonly held misconceptions get in the way of seeking care or recovering from your injury. So we got a great lineup today of some other questions. This is part two of a three-part series. Craig, what'd you think about the last episode? I felt like we dropped quite a few knowledge bombs there.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, it's important to hear this stuff because we hear it so common that I know some of our listeners out there are absolutely thinking of it, or maybe they've kind of said those things themselves, but maybe didn't have a chance to talk to a provider about it. I think we kind of get caught up in this like old school way of thinking, and it's kind of like, you know, maybe you just heard it from someone else who heard it from someone else, and now all of a sudden it's like the norm, and you know, no one ever got, you know, fact checked or whatever. So I think that it's, you know, for all our listeners out there, that, you know, it's nice to hear this kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got five brand new questions for you guys today. Five brand new myths, I should say, for you guys today. So we're going to kick this thing off. Craig, why don't you start us off about talking about our first misconception or myth? My hips and spine are out of alignment. Now, just before we dive too deep into this, we have an entire podcast on this. So this topic in and of itself, it's super deep. There's a lot of research behind it. It really breaks down a lot of myths and misconceptions. But what we want to do today is kind of give you a brief summary of that, because we could spend a whole hour talking about this. So we're going to hit some of the key points, and then we'll move on to the next myth. So Craig, get us started, man.
Yeah, definitely. Weekly, I hear this one at least one time a week, guaranteed. And I think the reason to, you know, revisit again in this podcast is because it's so common. So hopefully, if you haven't checked out our old ones, you know, listen to that one. Great information there. But my big problem with this question or the statement that, you know, comes in is I think it's kind of like an old school view of stuff. You know, like back in the day, we didn't have much research on this kind of stuff. And it was more like something's out of a line kind of mindset, kind of like a car mentality. Like if something is wrong with your car, something, a specific part is not working or a specific piece is not working. And if that piece is replaced, then everything just kind of resets, you know? So I think people, we try to view that as the body in some way. So if I'm having, you know, back pain or if I'm having hip pain, then something in my low back or something in my hip is just not sitting right. And I think that, you know, some old school providers out there, and I'm not bashing on anyone's knowledge base, you know, this stuff is constantly evolving. The stuff we tell you today might be outdated in 10 years. We have no idea, but might have said something like they kind of check your hips and it's like, you know what? This piece looks a little higher than this piece. I think it's out of a line. So I'm going to give you a technique, or I'm going to do this technique to you that now is going to, you know, realign things. And we've kind of found after looking at that for a while that that doesn't tend to be the case. But I think as a patient, it is nice to hear, and it's like easy to digest, like, oh, now this is out, it's back in, the piece is fixed, now everything can kind of work back to normal. So I think that doing those techniques and making someone feel good is super important, but the way that we justify it or what we tell the patient is, you know, is super important. Is this something, I know I tend to work with more of like the general population, people that have had pain for a long time. Do you see this in the CrossFit athlete, you know, weekend warrior, you know, setting as well?
Absolutely. I see this all the time. What tends to happen is I'll see people on these very long-term treatment plans that are required to keep their body in alignment. I think one of the interesting aspects or components of this that people don't think about is a lot of times an image, an x-ray, or, you know, something will be done and the provider might say, hey, look, here's the pieces or parts that are out of alignment. I need to see you for X amount of time to put you back in alignment. But there's no like repeat x-ray at the end of the road that shows that things are back in alignment. So you're just kind of forever thrust into this malaligned program that you need for the rest of your life to continue to get aligned correctly. So I think, you know, so part of this fallacy is the body itself is very robust. And so what we don't realize is we have muscles, tendons, ligament, bones, all these different structures that are holding things in place. Our body doesn't just, you know, pop right out of alignment. It's not like how you dislocate a shoulder. Like I can't just pop my shoulder right out of its joint. there has to be some sort of trauma, or that has to be some sort of laxity. Now, we do have some types of diseases that cause like increased elasticity within our joints, and things like that, where patients will be much more hypermobile and they'll be able to self-manipulate and those sorts of things. But even that, the pop itself is not a joint realigning. The pop itself is just, it's a gas bubble being released. And what we actually call that gas bubble a cavitation. And what we know about that now that we didn't know before, we used to think that it was realigning something. Currently, what we know now based on lots and lots of evidence and literature is it provides a short-term pain relief once that pressure release happens, releases some endorphins. So you will get some lasting effects for a few hours or maybe even up to a day, but oftentimes it's short-lived. So we need to follow that up with other things. And usually that's some sort of active movement that keeps that that short-term pain relief and kind of extends it into a more long-term type of pain relief. Anything that you can think of that I'm missing with that, Craig?
I think you did a great job explaining it. I think the key thing to remember there is the body and the spine, super strong, pelvis especially, incredibly stable. But like you kind of mentioned, there are some active structures, muscles, tendons that do attach to those pieces of the body. So, you know, can you have some compensated movement there? Maybe one area is weak, one area is tight, you know, like, of course, maybe that's why things are going on. You know, it's not really like a bony alignment sort of thing. And, you know, sometimes if we take a step back and look at some real world examples, I'll use this with my patients sometimes that come in and say, like, my hips are out of line because I took a weird step. Or maybe I exercised or walked a little more than I have in the past. And, you know, and to me, I kind of say like, well, let's take a look at like pro athletes or people that have been in car accidents. Like they're on the extreme end of forces that are put into their body. And you never hear like a running back gets hit in football and all of a sudden his pelvis is out of whack. Like he's right. Getting hit by another 250-pound linebacker. And, you know, it's not like he's getting up and all of a sudden his like body is now, you know, in shambles and out of line. Or I see people, you know, that have been in, you know, car accidents and it's not like they're coming in and their hips are all out of space or their back is not in a place that it should be. So I think that there are many real world examples where people are exposed to some pretty serious levels of force and there's no like talk of misalignment then. So I just kind of caution people to say that like less intrusive things, working out, walking, you know, those, you know, not really a good basis if you kind of think about it to even cause the sort of stuff in the first place.
Yeah. If tremendous amounts of force won't put you necessarily out of alignment, especially repeated tremendous amounts of force being used against your body in sports like football, I'm pretty sure like stepping the wrong way or rolling over in bed isn't going to throw your whole system off. Great point there. So Craig, on to the next one. This is another one we get pretty frequently. A lot of times patients, when they get an injury, the first thing they think of is surgery. So the next myth that we want to handle is my blank just started to hurt. So you can insert any body part there, shoulder, neck, back, hip, knee. My blank just started to hurt. I don't want to get surgery. Ready, go.
Again, another super common one. And I've even heard this from other healthcare providers, you know, not in the rehab field. And I think the first thing that is super important to realize is that the pain response is normal, it's necessary, and it's important. So when something first starts to hurt, it's kind of our body's way of saying, and we're talking more of like acute pain. Like I just went to go lift up something heavy and now my arm hurts. Or I bench pressed for the first time in a long time and now my shoulder hurts. Or I jumped off a step and now my leg hurts kind of deal. You know, it's a little bit of a different talk if, you know, you come in and say, well, I've had pain for months kind of deal. So we're talking initial sort of injury here. But back to what I was saying, the pain response, necessary, important, and normal, because it's kind of our body's and our brain's way of reminding us not to kind of push further. Our body has a great natural healing response, but sometimes we need to take a step back and sort of let it, work itself out. That pain doesn't always mean that there's like a significant tissue damage, but it does mean that we kind of have to modify our activity. And I think where we get in trouble is the time frame that takes. And I think that as patients, we don't, as us as the providers, we don't do a great job telling people how long that's going to take. And we're going to provide a couple examples here with various types of injuries. But when our pain response kicks on, it stays on for a little bit of time, pending the, you know, severity of damage, if there is any, or the type of tissue that's going on. So my big thing is, just because you have pain and the next day it's still there, doesn't mean that some level of irreparable damage has happened. So is that something you talk about, Drew, or how do you typically see someone that comes in, you know, fresh injury, and their mind immediately races, you know, something serious has to happen to make them better?
Yeah. For me, I typically like to classify injuries in two different categories. Okay. So I will classify them in overuse or progressive onset. So that's one category. So overuse, you go to the gym, you do something you haven't done in a long time, like you mentioned the bench press, and say you went kind of heavy, you did more reps than you typically would have done, and you hadn't bench pressed in maybe, I don't know, let's say 2 months, and you overdid it. You might get a flare up of shoulder pain. So that'd be what I'd classify as like an overuse injury. And then the progressive onset is, you woke up one morning, you had a little crick in your neck, and then over time that crick in your neck got a little bit worse, a little bit worse, a little bit worse, over the course of maybe 2 months or over the course of 2 weeks. So something happened, you slept a funny way, and then it is slowly and gradually getting a little bit worse. These are typically non-surgical in most cases, okay? Very rarely does something like this require surgery. Where we're looking at something a little bit different is the other type of injury that I try to classify things. So we have your overuse or progressive onset, and then we also have trauma. So with trauma, we're talking more about motor vehicle accidents, falling off a ladder, you know, being hit playing football or in sports, blow to the knee, those sorts of things. There's some sort of external force that is impacting your body. Now, in these cases, surgery is oftentimes a little bit more common, because you can break a bone, and if that bone becomes displaced, it might need to be surgically repaired and put back to where it naturally should be, or else you completely will lose function over that specific body part. So trauma in and of itself typically lends to more serious types of injuries that become or are surgical. If something is more overuse or progressive onset, they're usually along the times, or they're usually what we consider like non-surgical cases, can be healed with conservative care naturally without even needing injections, opiates, pain medication, surgery, any of that stuff. You know, the other thing that we wanted to discuss too is tissue healing times. So a lot of times we get this idea of, okay, well, something, say I have a tendonitis. How long does it take for a tendonitis to improve? We have some natural healing times, and we also have some healing times when we go through therapy. So I would say, you know, to treat a tendon, if I'm seeing someone with plantar fasciitis or Achilles tendonitis or tendinosis or different problems like that, I would say the healing time's a little bit accelerated. But there is some research out there that discusses the normal tissue healing time frames. So Craig, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I think that this sort of highlights the reason why it's so important to, you know, see a specialist. Because I think part of our job is figuring out why do you have pain in the first place? Is this truly like musculoskeletal in nature? You know, is this just some acute inflammatory process, or is this coming from something that is, you know, not musculoskeletal in nature? You know, and once we figure that out, then we can tend to be a little bit more, you know, specific as far as our education is concerned and timeframes for healing. But just some general, like, I would say pretty good rules of thumb that I will kind of, you know, educate people on is, if we're thinking this might be a muscular problem, for example. So let's say you just had a really hard workout. You said my muscles were really sore. I'm nervous that they're really sore. Is this good? Like, how long does this even take to get better? Where that's, you know, a couple of days. We're talking maybe, you know, 0 to 3, 4 days, something like that. But if we get, you know, we'd like to grade things in physical therapy. If we have what we call a grade 1, you know, muscle injury. So, you know, grade 1, 2, and 3, 1 is a, you know, not severe at all. 2 is like this middle gray area of, you know, we might have a little bit of tissue damage going on, but not overly severe. Grade 3 is the, like, yeah, it's pretty severe. Can you get away without surgery? You know, yes, but like in some cases, do you need surgery? You know, also yes, but, in that's when things get a little more hairy. That's why you have to come see somebody like us, so we can say, you know what, this seems like on the less severe, this seems like a muscle injury, seems like it's on the less severe end. I would call it in that, you know, grade one territory. Okay, that could take anywhere from, you know, 0 days to 3 to 4 weeks of healing time. But if we think, you know what, if this seems a little bit more serious, there's some markers we use to say this might be like in the grade two, you know, range, then maybe we're talking 3 weeks to maybe a couple months. And then if we kind of hit that grade three range, we'll say, you know what, this does look like a serious problem. Maybe this is something where we actually do need to investigate, like would surgery help? Or are we going to go conservative with this? But we need to expect like this might take, you know, 5, 6 weeks all the way up to maybe like 4, 5, 6 months kind of deal, you know? And I think just using muscle as one example, you can kind of see that depending on our exam, you know, whoever you might be seeing, that figuring out like how this happened, where we're going to put this on our sliding scale of severity and how that's going to affect how long it takes to get better.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And a lot of times I'll have patients where if you're kind of in that weird zone of, you know what, this might be surgical, this might not. One good example, I had a patient with a complete PCL tear come to me. First, they hadn't seen a surgeon, they hadn't had an MRI, any of that stuff. You know, I was able to use some of my testing, diagnose, hey, this is a PCL tear. We need to see if any other ligaments are involved. So in this case, the patient did go and get an MRI. That MRI did demonstrate and show complete PCL tear, but nothing else was damaged. The good news is with complete PCL tears, you do have an opportunity to, you know, some people are what we call copers. A coper is someone who doesn't require the ligament to have good knee stability and return back to sport and do some of the things that they want to get back to. But you don't know if someone's typically a coper. There's some tests that you can do to try and identify them, but you don't know unless you try the rehab process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in that case, we're pretty upfront with people. If we identify this or we say, hey, you could be a coper, you might not be a coper. Here are your options. There's the surgical approach, or you may be able to avoid surgery completely. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I'm willing to give this a shot with you and see where it goes. You know, and luckily we were able to patch him up, get him back on the field. He finished out his, you know, senior season and there was no issues. Still never got surgery, and has moved on, continues to play sports. And, you know, we had a very good outcome. But on the flip side of that, it could have gone the other way because there was such extensive tissue damage there. So it's one of those situations where it's always good to seek out a professional's advice, because from there we can be upfront and let you know exactly what's going on and, you know, realistically what both sides of the coin look like.
Right. And just to follow up on that, and this is related to this topic, but also I'm going to trail off a little bit here because I think it is relatable. A big thing I tend to see, and this is going back to the true importance of patient education, is there is a tissue in your knee called the meniscus. A lot of people have heard of it. Basically, your knee kind of connects together. And there are these two little cushions on the inside of the knee that kind of help provide a little bit of stability, a little padding for the knee. It's something that is commonly, you know, worn down as you age. And a lot of times, now there's, of course, acute injuries where, you know, something happens and you get a tear. That's a little different story. But, you know, as you age, these things are really prone to damage. So someone might think, I might need surgery for this. And there's plenty of research out there comparing, you know, one group, you know, gets their imaging diagnosed with torn meniscus. They do conservative care for, you know, 8 to 12 weeks. They, you know, they work on their exercise, they come to PT, and then there's group two that they get surgery, and then they do their 8 to 12 weeks of physical therapy. And at the end, both groups do about the same. So the surgery group and the non-surgery group, their function, their level of pain is, you know, near identical. The point I'm trying to make here is in the non-surgical group, during that 8 to 12 weeks, like they have to get that education that you might have a little bit of knee pain, but it's going to get better with time. For most people, 8 to 12 weeks. And that tends to be helpful. I think patients that have pain and it doesn't get better after, you know, 2, 3, 4 weeks, like, you know, immediately you're going to start catastrophizing. Like, of course, why wouldn't you? You know, you have no background in this. But for the surgical group, I think that when people get surgery and it's like maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks after surgery, they're like, well, my knee still hurts. Like the easy answer is like, well, you just had knee surgery. You got to let it have time to figure, and people are willing to accept that, you know, because it makes sense.
It makes sense.
So I think if we did a better job explaining that, I think that could, you know, healing time can be super helpful.
Absolutely. So on to the next myth. This one's, these are some of the favorites. I see this a ton in like the CrossFit community or hardcore weightlifters, power lifters. these types of communities. And we thought it was really important to incorporate this one into this talk. So there's two that kind of go together. So the first one is no pain, no gain. And then there's also pain is weakness leaving the body. These are two I see plastered on every gym wall. You know, I think there's some people who take it into the context that they're supposed to take it in, where like if you're thinking pain is more muscle soreness or like fatigue, then I think like if you substitute that in there, I think it's more of an okay statement. But as far as like true pain in the sense that there's like a tissue lesion or there's some sort of pathology involved, we got a couple things to say about that. So Craig, why don't you get us started?
Right. And this is like drilled into your head. If any high school athlete is listening out there, you know, you can near guarantee that this was told to you at least a million times as you were playing your high school sport. And I think that it is appropriate in some places and not appropriate in others. You kind of touched on that. I think this was something that was born out of like a athletic performance or sports training sort of world. And I think that it depends on what you're doing, whether this statement becomes appropriate or not. So if I want to run ultra marathons, or if I want to be a competitive bodybuilder, I'm going to need to push myself to likely a point of fatigue. And once I hit that point of fatigue, things might start to happen. So I might have an achy muscle because there is just a physiological limit that my muscle is able to take. Typically, your mind will break before the muscle will break. That's, again, our body's protection system at work. So there needs to be some coach there, some person saying that, I know it's, you know, hurting right now, but you need to push through that. And I think that there needs to be a trained person doing that. And I think under the right circumstances with the right people and the right place and the right time, that that's appropriate if we're looking for high-end performance. So in our world, we can be dealing with high-end performance, but we could also be dealing with the opposite end to where, like you said, Drew, you're having pain now, not because you're pushing your body's system to its limit, but because something within the system is already damaged and it's sending a signal saying, hey, you might be causing more harm or damage here. So that is a time when it's, you know, not so appropriate, and we need to take a step back and say, this isn't the no pain, no gain time. You know, this isn't the high performance setting. This is the, you know, the rehab setting. And I'm sure on the CrossFit end and the, you know, athlete end that you deal with, you probably get this a lot. So is this something that you have to explain? Or I guess if a patient was being treated by you and, you know, you're doing your exercises with them and you ask them, does this hurt? And they say, yeah, but you know what? No pain, no gain. How do you go about that?
You know, I start with educating them and I talk about the different types of problem. So let's say somebody comes in and they have what we call like tendon pain. So not necessarily a tendonitis, but let's call it like a tendinosis or a tendinopathy. So again, for those of you who haven't been following along in the podcast, in past episodes, tendinosis and tendinopathy are typically what we see when we have tendon irritation in the clinic. Most people don't, when they arrive at the clinic, they don't have tendinitis because that usually occurs in a very short window of time right after the injury happens. So usually we're seeing people with a little bit more irritable tendons over that have been lingering for a little bit of some time. So when we see someone with tendon pain, we're actually okay with loading them through a little bit of pain. So some pain is okay. If I get a CrossFitter or an athlete and I'm trying to keep them training during rehab, what I'll do is I'll give them a rule. I'll call it the 2-point pain rule. I'll say, if you can keep your pain between like a 0 and a 2 out of 10, I'm good with you working through a little bit of pain. Because what we know is a little bit of pain can actually be slightly therapeutic for a tendon problem. However, here's the big asterisk. If it's most other types of pain, it's not a good idea to push through it. And here's why. Let's say you have a ligament. You have a grade 2 ACL sprain, for example. And we'll go off the grading model that you discussed earlier. That could mean that there might be a partial tear in the ligament. Okay. Now, if you have pain with certain movements, you're probably putting undue stress on that ligament that you don't need to put on it. You don't want to stress that ligament while it's still in the healing process. So you want to try to keep all of those movements pain-free to limit any further tissue damage. Now, does all pain equal tissue damage? No. But we also don't know what pain does or doesn't equal tissue damage, right? We don't have like a sensor that says, oh, this is you know, this is completely safe or this is completely dangerous. We don't know for sure. So the goal is when we know that a ligament has been damaged and there's been undue stress to it and it's in the healing process, we try to load you as much as we can without pain. Same thing goes with nerves. So if you have a pinched nerve in your neck, pinched nerve in your back, anything like that, we want to keep you pain-free. Nerves are tend to be highly irritable. So if you place too much tension on them, too much strain on them, you will actually get a flare-up later on. The goal of rehab is to reduce flare-ups and increase the number of therapeutic things that we provide to the lesion or to the problem in order to solve the problem once and for all. But if we keep aggravating the issue, we're just going to either stay exactly where we are or we're going to continue to worsen the condition, and it's going to delay recovery time. So with nerves, we don't want to push through pain. So we do need to play a little bit of a either modify or avoid certain movements for a short period of time and then slowly reintroduce them again once the lesion is under control. Discs, same sort of thing. Discs can be sensitive to different types of forces placed upon them. In most people, discs can be sensitive to flexion or bending forward. So people with bad disc herniations oftentimes will struggle to bend forward. It's not in all cases, but in a majority of cases. We don't continue to bend them forward through pain because things will usually flare up and get worse. And this is evident in most CrossFit athletes with repeated flexion. So deadlifts, back squats, movements like that that inherently have lumbar flexion and load attributed to them at the exact same time. I guess the other population that is probably a little bit kind of exempt, we're allowed to push them through a little bit of pain, is someone who's been in chronic pain. Now, when I say chronic, I mean somebody who's been in pain for, you know, years. Okay, they live at a constant level of pain no matter what. These folks, we can kind of use the 2-point pain rule with them as well. If they start, you know, exercising or moving and their pain level is maybe a 3 out of 10, as long as we keep them between a 3 and a 5 out of 10, they should be okay. They won't get a flare up. But there's no way to keep someone who has been in chronic pain, who already has pain before you even touch them, before you do anything with them. There's no way to keep them pain free, if that makes sense. They're already living in a state of pain. So your goal is to minimize any sort of flare-ups at that point and then introduce things that are therapeutic. You know, Craig, what are your thoughts on muscle fatigue?
How do you and I think that's the tough part. I think that's where we sort of started off here, is it's okay to work into, like, so muscle fatigue, people can register that differently, right? Like if I was doing, for example, bicep curls until I felt like I couldn't do many more, that could be, you know, I would consider that muscle fatigue, where to me that might register as pain, whereas to you that might register as soreness, whereas someone, you know, standing next to us, that might just be like stiffness or tightness kind of deal. And you talking about all the various tissues just a second ago highlights the importance of like where people are on the scale, right? Like, when is pain okay? When is pain not okay? And I think it's confusing and it's tough to navigate that. And I think that's why our job as physical therapists are so important, because like, this is our level of expertise. You know, this is like teasing out, like, is this an appropriate time for pain? Is this not an appropriate time for pain? Or we may be feeling something that is more on the muscle fatigue anatomical end where this is okay. Or are we thinking like, you know what, maybe this is a time where we really need to cut back.
Yeah. And I mean, your YouTube videos won't tell you that, right? Because
absolutely not. And it's not something.
Yeah.
You don't just watch it and you're like, oh, well, that's it. You know, like, it's that easy. No, it typically takes time, you know, because all of this, like I said, it's easy to say out loud, right? But like the intricacies and the nuances are so different from person to person that it's a process, you know, it's a process that you have to work through. And it's not that kind of just quick result, watch your 30-second, you know, video and then you're good to go kind of deal.
I think it's also interesting, and I'm sure you get this a lot in the clinic, patients always are somewhat, I guess you could say, like, surprised at how well I can predict what is going to aggravate their symptoms. You know, they can tell me, hey, these three things, you know, this is what my symptoms are, this is where they're located. you know, I'm a CrossFitter and I can say, oh, I bet these four movements will make your problem worse. And they're like, yes, exactly. You know, and that's because we understand how a disc behaves. We understand how a tendon behaves. Like all of these different structures in our body, they behave a certain way. So we have to provide them with the appropriate stimulus, because if we don't, you just continue to get a flare up. So do you see that as well, where you can find, basically have a patient tell you a few things and you basically say, hey, let's minimize this or let's tweak this. And then the patient comes back for that next visit and says, hey, I've had no flare ups, or you know what, things have been much better recently because I've cut some of that stuff out.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. Just this past week, I was working with a patient, and you know, we were working through this kind of process, doing exactly what you were saying, and they just looked at me and were like, "Am I weird? Like, does this make sense? What's happening to me?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, you know." And I think we like take for granted, like me and you see that so much,
yeah,
you know. But like as a patient, like unless you have someone with the exact same thing going on as you, like how would you ever know, you know, what that's supposed to feel like? So I countless times get like, they'll ask me like, well, does this make sense? It doesn't make sense to me, you know, like, you know, does this make sense to you? And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, and I think these things will also aggravate it. And they're like, well, yeah, how did you know that?
I never thought about that.
Like, yeah, wait a minute.
You know, now, don't so get I me wrong. Like, I do get patients who come to me with some weird stuff and I'm like, okay, this is going to take a few visits for us to figure out. But for the most part, things are pretty straightforward. Most lesions behave the same way, or tissues. I keep saying lesions, but like most pathology behaves a certain way and has certain clinical characteristics, I should say, that are pretty predictable. And then from there, treatment becomes pretty simple once we make the adaptations we need to make.
Yeah, agreed. So for our last topic here, this is my favorite one, because I hear it all the time and it's just like hard to hammer home for a lot of people. So we absolutely have to talk about it here.
Absolutely.
Our fourth myth. I don't want to lift weights because I don't want to get bulky. What do you think about that one there, Dr. Drew?
This one is huge. If a day doesn't go by where I don't hear someone talking about this in the gym, or a patient doesn't bring it up to me, or you know, people, they have secret insecurities about it, where, you know, they might work out, but they might, you know, in the back of their head, they're like, okay, I'm lifting all these weights, but like, hopefully I don't get bulky. I don't know how this is going to turn out. So there's a lot to unpack here, but we're going to try and condense it as best we can. So if you don't want to get bulky, lifting weights, honestly, your bulkiness would come from a larger intake of calories, most likely. Now, obviously there's different ways you can train. You can train with heavy loads and, you know, try to develop strength. You can train what we call like hypertrophy, which is like moderate loads and repetitions, or you can train endurance, which is high repetitions, very low loads. Okay. You can use some of that to train a certain way and try not to develop what we call like bulk, but ultimately diet and nutrition seem to be the key here. You know, if you're eating lots and lots of calories and you're lifting heavy, you're going to develop more muscle. You're going to develop more strength. On the flip side, if you're lifting very low loads, okay, and you're cutting calories, you're not actually going to put on much muscle. And then the flip side, if you're lifting very heavy loads and you're cutting calories, you're still probably going to remain lean. So diet is actually probably more of the key factor in this equation than the type of loads that you're lifting, because you won't put on muscle if your diet is not in check. You can work out all you want. You can work out hard and heavy, but if you can't out-train a bad diet, you know, that's probably the one, healthcare saying or fitness saying that I would say is pretty accurate. You know, we almost have to do like some healthcare or fitness truths. We might have to do one of those podcasts as well. But I would say you can't out-train a bad diet. And I think that's consistent across the board. You won't see someone eating horrible all their life and then training and training and training and actually get like stellar results that way. What do you think, Craig?
Yeah, I think the whole strength and conditioning rabbit hole is deep and confusing and very you know, convoluted, but, and I don't consider myself, you know, a true expert in like the strength and conditioning world. But like you said, when it comes to like changing your body, whether it be bulking, cutting, you know, getting huge, as a lot of people say, I think of it as like a pyramid. And I think I can confidently say this, with the base of the pyramid being the most important. And that would be your genetic potential. Some of us are just built, you know, body type, you know, just genetically, how are we engineered? On top of that would be diet. And then the pinnacle of the triangle, the real small, almost insignificant part is exercise, right? So if those two things below it aren't in check or don't allow for a specific thing, then it's not like you're going to pick up weights one day and then all of a sudden you're going to put on this crazy amount of muscle mass. If you're listening to our podcast, you're not able to see me, but if you check out the YouTube videos, you'll see me sitting in the chair here. I've been lifting for a while, not huge, you know. I also ate a stack of pancakes this morning, so I think the nutrition part is you know, my personal, you know, vice, if you will. But I think that, you know, people spend a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort, emphasis on the time, years to like sculpt themselves into this like incredible looking person that you see on TV or Instagram. And that is a lifestyle, you know, not, that's just not like I picked up some weights and now all of a sudden, like I look like this freak of nature kind of deal. And I think people worry about that, even though it's pretty far from the truth. And I think if you talk to people that are really involved in the health and fitness community, you know, they would absolutely agree with us. And then moving a little bit more to like our end, like the rehab end, people think that like lifting weights is only meant to get you bigger or get you stronger, but we also use it for a couple different things. So we can use weightlifting and strength training to provide, you know, specific tissue loading or to help, you know, modulate pain and just work on some pain control. We can do muscle activation exercises. We can improve motor patterns, or even people that have, you know, osteoporosis, we can do weight bearing exercise for bone health. So it's not like every time we'll talk about resistance training, that's the goal to make your muscles necessarily bigger. There's a lot of underlying things, you know, that can happen. Not to get too sciencey with it, but there's a term called mechanotransduction, basically, that means when we provide an external load or some type of resistance to our muscles, there's specific little muscle cells in there that get that input and they signal to the rest of the body to, you know, act appropriately. Our body is constantly breaking down, rebuilding up, breaking down and rebuilding up. And it's kind of that, if you don't use it, you lose it phenomenon, and doing some sort of resistance exercise kind of signals into the body and your muscle saying, hey, like, let's make sure we don't lose it. And that doesn't necessarily mean getting, you know, bulky or big.
Yeah, exactly. I think that that misconception about I'm going to get bulky has stopped a lot of people, you know, or at least stops a lot of people from meeting their fitness goals. You know, their fear of getting bulky. And usually I would say this is, it's more of a something in society. It's more, you know, societal pressures of women feeling like they don't need to, or a have a fear of getting bulky. But at the same time, there are hormone differences as well. And, you know, we haven't, that kind of falls under the genetics area, I guess you could say too. You know, it's a lot harder for females to get bulky because they don't produce as much testosterone as, you know, most males would produce. And so from a hormonal standpoint, you know, it would be, it's much more difficult for a woman to become very, very, I guess you could say, bulky compared to how a male would become bulky. So, and that's another kind of point that I think is sound and needs to be made here, in that if it's mostly women saying this, another even more reason why you should add resistance training into your exercise routine is that the likelihood of you becoming very bulky is relatively lower, especially, you know, if your goals are like weight loss. The chance of you becoming bulky and trying to lose weight at the same time are very, very low. Usually, if anything, you're gonna slim down and develop more of what some of the common words that are used in the fitness industry look more tone, you know. So you might see that before you would see more bulk.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And I think that's a good kind of segue into our last point here. you know, a common excuse not wanting to lift weights because you don't want to get bulky. But another common excuse for not exercising, and I hear this a lot in my practice, is I just don't have time for exercise. I know, Drew, you work with maybe some a clientele that maybe appreciates the benefit of exercise. But especially in rehab, you know, people have so many things going on in their life. How do you respond when someone says, I don't have time for exercise?
You know, honestly, I think this is a question that's better equipped for you. most of my folks, they have plenty of time for exercise. If anything, I can't slow them down. A lot of times I'll ask people like, oh, well, how many training sessions do you have a week? That's just part of my standard intake form, which I know in the hospitals, that's never asked, right? That's not on any intake form in the hospitals. That's not part of any subjective screening. But usually every single person that comes in my office say, you know, are you on a current training program? How many days a week? How many recovery days do you have? And then I'll say, what's your volume like, or what's your loads like? Are they light, moderate, or heavy? So that I get an idea for, you know, how they're training, what they're training for, if their injury is impacting their current ability to train. And to be honest, most of my folks, they are training somewhere between 5 to 7 days a week. Some of them twice a day. So honestly, I see more of, I would probably say that I see more overtraining than I do of people who don't have time for exercise. So I'm going to let you kind of take the lead on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a conversation that I can easily say that I have daily. And there's two big things that come to mind when I hear this. And it's people have no idea the amount of time you need to exercise to have benefit. People have no idea. And then the second thing being is when I say exercise, for whatever reason, everyone's mind is programmed that it needs to be like at a gym or a sporting event or an exercise class, or it has to be on the treadmill or some, you know, involve some sort of piece of equipment. So to start off, how much exercising do you need for it to be beneficial? I think people think like, I got to go to an hour long exercise class, or I got to work out every day of the week. And that's 100% not true. So for cardiovascular exercise, and this is from the American Heart Association, ACSM guidelines. These are big organizations that get together, you know, every so often and kind of say, hey, what, you know, where do we get our most bang for our buck time-wise? And we can confidently say that 150 minutes of moderate exercise, and this isn't like I'm working until I feel like I'm going to pass out, or I'm like, you know, this is just, you just start to sweat, moderate exercise.
Increase your heart rate.
Just increase the heart rate to what we would consider a moderate amount, 150 minutes per week. So that's 22 minutes a day. Or you can break that up into however long, you know, you'd like. And it takes, I would say, 22 minutes. You can probably walk 1 mile in 22 minutes.
Yep.
If you're walking at what I would consider a moderate pace. So I think a mile a day of walking 22 minutes a day is not bad as far as exercise is concerned. If you really want to get after it, they recommend 75 minutes a week of vigorous exercise. And that's when you're feeling kind of strained. That should be hard, tough exercise. And if you're willing to, you know, hit that marker, that's 3 days a week of 25 minutes. So if you're someone that, you know, I don't have time to exercise, I don't have time to lose weight, do my cardio, I think everyone has about 25 minutes, you know, 3 days a week to kind of go after it. As far as strength training or resistance training is concerned, there are some, you know, recent studies out there looking at like how many reps, and how many sets, and what type of load do we need to achieve some sort of muscle growth. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily be pure strength, but enough to keep the muscle healthy and keep the muscle growing. And a lot of people think, I need to go to the gym for that. Because the gym has weights and I need to overload the muscle. And that is not necessarily true. So they have found that high volume, so I'm talking like, I think they use like 24 to maybe like 36 sets a week for exercise. So you can do a couple, you know, every other day, 3 days a week, you know, you're working near like 4 to 8 sets of maybe 10 to 20 reps of bodyweight exercises. And you can still, you know, even that's way submaximal as far as like a muscle loading thing is concerned, you can still see muscle hypertrophy benefits. So I don't have time for exercise. If you do your 22 minutes of cardio a day, and if you do your 6 sets of 15 of bodyweight squats, that could take 35 minutes or less. And I think that some people think that it has to be like some big robust program, you know, and that, you know, body weight exercise is still exercise. Stepping, using the steps in your house is an exercise. Doing chair squats, you know, is an exercise. Walking continuously with your friend every morning before you go to work is absolutely exercise. And it doesn't have to be every day either. So I think that seeing someone that's well-versed in this stuff can educate. So for all our listeners out there, if you say, I don't have time for exercise, I guarantee if you called up a physical therapist, a really good coach, or trainer and say, this is how much time I have, this is how many days of the week I have, I am certain that someone can make it work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think too, you know, if you think about 22 minutes a day and some of the activities that you spend more than 22 minutes on each day, you know, there's people who binge watch Netflix. We're talking, this isn't even like the length of one Netflix episode, right? I have a pretty crazy schedule, and I'm interested to hear what your schedule is like too. But for me, I get in about 2 to 3 vigorous exercise sessions a week with the current training program that I'm on. And I do about a 2-mile walk every single day with my dog and wife. We always go for a walk, at least one a day for about 2 miles. So we pretty much get it in. And I mean, I'll work like 11-hour days, sometimes 12-hour days, and I'm still able to at least get that walk in. That's kind of the one thing that I never let go to the wayside. Doesn't matter how busy I am. What is, like, how do you break yours up, or, you know, what's your training split right now?
For me right now, so I'm, you know, I have my full-time job. I'm actively pursuing a fellowship, so I have a lot of outside stuff going on there. But I like regiment. I'm a scheduled person, and I strongly advise my patients to be the same. Just kind of set out a time during the day that you just kind of, this is my exercise time. It's like brushing your teeth. Like if you haven't brushed your teeth in like months, the first couple weeks of brushing your teeth every night is going to suck, you know, totally understand it. But eventually you're going to kind of gear up. Okay, it's bedtime. I got to brush my teeth first. So what I typically like to do is I come home from work, I make a snack, I go work out, you know, like, that's just kind of how it is, you know? And if there's other stuff going on, you kind of stay consistent with it. And eventually it's built into your routine. So it just kind of feels right to do it. Or sometimes I'll have people try to set it up with something else that they do. Like if on the weekends you like to do laundry on Sundays, for example, I'll say, put your laundry in and then go walk until the laundry is done. Put the laundry in the dryer, and then do your strength training while your laundry is dry. You know, like incorporate it into like another piece of your life that you feel like you're not, like at that point, you're not wasting time doing exercise. You're doing laundry and you just happen to be exercising, you know, at the same time. So I think the number one key is consistency with this stuff, and like achieving the consistency is the hard part. And it's more of starting and initially sticking to it. And then once it becomes routine and you set it up into something you're already doing, then it becomes easier. It's the starting is the hardest part. Absolutely.
You got it, Craig. You got it. All right. Let's bring this thing home here. So what are some of the key points that our viewers or listeners can take home from the 5 minutes we talked about today? I know we hit on some really big, hefty topics, but if you had to summarize as best you could, you know, what should they take from this if they only watch this end part of the episode?
Got it. 5 myths. 5 key points coming at you. Number one, your hips and your spine are not out of alignment. If someone told you that, that is likely not true. Of course, there's going to be some, you know, the 1% cases out there, but by and large, the body is very stable. It's very robust and it's not going anywhere. So you do not need to be put back into alignment. Number two, the pain response is necessary. It's important and it's needed. Pain or injury very rarely requires surgery unless, again, it's something very obvious. It should always be the last resort. So make sure you see a specialist to figure out what kind of pain you're having and then maybe what degree of damage or insult to their body there might be, and then start talking about the need to have surgery. Number three, no pain equals more gains. Get out of pain and improve muscle activation and motor patterns is the key there. And just like we talked about, it's a simple statement, but it can be a little bit complex. It's just that would be a tip of the iceberg statement. So the majority of the iceberg is under the water, the stuff you can't see. So seeing someone like a physical therapist might say, you know, this is a time where we got to avoid pain. This is a time where we can push into a little bit of pain, or this is a time we might be able to work into a painful area. So just kind of be careful with your advice that you're getting and make sure you see someone that is, you know, an expertise, that has some level of expertise in this area. Number four, go lift weights and don't worry about bulking up. Straight and simple. If you do figure out how to just lift minimal weights and end up getting huge, let me know or Drew know at our email, because we would love to figure out how to do that. You know, I could use that myself for certain. And then number five, you definitely have time for exercise. It's even if you don't have 20 minutes, something is always better than nothing. I will tell you that, you know, every single time. At the very minimum, 20 minutes per day is all you need to get great cardiovascular benefits. The number one thing is just starting out. That's the hardest part. Make it a priority for your long-term health and wellness. Consistency is likely the problem in this case, and not time.
Awesome, Craig. Yeah, I think I agree with all those points. You nailed them. I think our viewers are going to get so much value from this podcast episode. I think the key points give a great summary as to, you know, really the take home, what you guys should be focusing on and why these myths need to be dispelled. Because I think the five, especially the five that we talked about today, run rampant in our society. They run rampant in our brains, and they hinder us from doing the things that we need to do on a daily basis. So that being said, we're going to wrap up this episode. Thank you for tuning into the Straight Talk Physio podcast. If you like what you're hearing, it would mean the world to us if you subscribe to this podcast and the Peak Physiotherapy and Performance YouTube channel. For more information about us, please check us out on Facebook at Peak Physiotherapy and Performance and on Instagram at P3 Physiotherapy. For more information about Craig, you can follow him at DrCraigG_PT on Twitter and Instagram. If you have any topic suggestions, comments, or questions, then feel free to email us at thestraighttalkphysiopodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again for watching, and we hope you guys have an awesome day.